This is the Power Producers Podcast,
where we are refining and redefining the sales game.
Rule number one is you have to believe in yourself. You're the only one who doesn't think you belong in this appointment. The prospect has already validated your existence by scheduling time with you. Get it through your head you belong here, go in there, crush it, and close the deal.
A place where sales professionals can come to learn from other sales professionals and thought leaders that have mastered their craft.
The difference between a good salesperson and a best-in-class salesperson is only 2 minutes. By spending an extra 2 minutes on what you might think is a mundane task in the sales game, you separate yourselves from the pack, you grow your book of business, you close more deals, and you retain your accounts.
As well as their peers who are still striving for perfection to achieve their why.
I have a wife and 4 kids. Failure is not an option.
Real sales professionals. Real stories. Real results.
It's no different than being a professional baseball player. You can't be a one-trick pony. You have to be a 5-tool player in order to succeed in this game.
This is the Power Producers Podcast, production redefined. Are you ready to feel the power?
Hey everybody, welcome to the Power Producers Podcast, where we are refining and redefining the sales game, and I'm standing for the first time ever. This is the maiden voyage of the new autonomous desk. And I got to tell you, man, I love it. It is ridiculous. I might even screw around a little bit, pull the chair over and hit the button in the middle and give you like the fake walking down the steps, but it won't be fake because I'm actually going
to
be
sitting down. You need to get your Birkenstocks on.
Yeah, that is not going to happen ever. Today, we are joined by Mr. Rob Bowen with Patriotic Insurance Group. Now, Rob, are you in Pennsylvania or New York? I know that you're close to New York, but I think you're in Pennsylvania, aren't you?
My office is in New York, in Chester, New York. I actually live in Milford, Pennsylvania, which is about 40 miles west.
So you're in both?
I'm in both, yep. I got out of New York as soon as my son went to college.
What's that commute like?
It's on a highway that speed limit's about 65. It's like 40 minutes, and I get a chance to listen to your podcast while I drive back and forth to work.
I actually live less than 5 minutes from the office, and I miss the commute. Like, that was the thing for me.
Clear your
back
head.
Back in the day. What's that? Exactly. When I was in the grocery business, man, it didn't matter how bad my day was. You know, I had the ability to prep for it going in, you know, by just listening to whatever or just thinking about what I was going to do all day. That's usually a good one. And then on the way home, I could decompress. Now, if I leave the office pissed off, I'm still pissed off when I get home.
Like just driving to work with Thunderstruck on, blaring.
Yeah, for no reason.
With your 12s thumping.
Yeah, exactly. And just, well, back in the day, man, I was just shotgunning surges. Like, they don't even make that anymore.
Dude, I wish I would slam a surge right now. Those were so good.
They actually sound dangerous. They're probably
illegal. They are. They're horrible for you. You know what?
That was pre-energy drink.
46 countries.
Was it? So it's basically sugar and caffeine, you know, concentrated in a bottle.
Dude, those came out when I was in like fourth or fifth grade, and they were so horrible for you. But we used to make a concoction with those mixed with Warheads, the little sour candies.
Oh, I remember those. Okay.
Yeah.
God, you sound like an interesting childhood.
To say the least.
Bet you weren't out shooting wasps off your pool screen like Ethan.
I wasn't.
No. But that'd be a dangerous combination with all that surge and shooting.
Up on surge.
Mean, yeah.
You know, surge just sort of disappeared one day, man. I don't know.
Out of nowhere.
What was in it?
People kept saying that the Yellow 5 was shrinking people's wieners, so they just like stopped. They stopped making it.
I probably need a 2-liter then. Yeah. I'm just kidding, people. Just don't even bother sending the email.
Oh,
anyhow,
man.
Well, listen, Rob, before we get ourselves in trouble, why don't you talk a little bit about your agency and you know, sort of how you got in the insurance industry? Because I know your background's military, right?
Yes. So I'll do it relatively quick. I went to college, got out in '86, joined the military in 1987, was in the military till 1995, served in Desert Shield. So we were one of the first carriers pulled into the Gulf when he invaded Kuwait. So that was a lot of fun back in 1990. And got out of the military, went down on Wall Street, did that for about 13, 14 years. So worked at Bank of New York, rated life insurance companies at S&P, Standard & Poor's. 2008 happened, you know, the old mortgage crisis that we all remember and will probably happen again in the next year or so.
I was getting ready to say, man, it's like a flashback, like the late 90s, early 2000s are happening all over again.
It's gonna crash for different reasons, but it's got all the same metrics coming in. It's just unfortunate. It's a matter of time here. But and then in 2014, decided to want to open up an insurance agency. Went the State Farm route. They honestly didn't like the fact that I didn't want to really listen to them and be told what to do. So I went the Farmers route for about 5 years. And November of last year, now I'm truly independent. So I'm free from the captive side. We had built up a pretty good, we were allowed to write outside business. So we do a lot of excess surplus in New York. So I had a pretty good sized book of excess surplus commercial business. And so we went independent in November, and it'd been rolling ever since, trying to figure out this whole independent side. Talking to everyone I can and having people guide me through it. But it's been an interesting ride. I love what I do. And I think, you know, this industry has a lot of potential.
You know, I always wonder if people who come from the captive side have it easier or harder than people who didn't have an agency at all before. I mean, for me, the learning curve wasn't necessarily how the insurance piece worked or any of that. It's more the operations side. And I didn't have a long history in production before I launched the agency. I mean, I did, but I wasn't involved in any of the ops, which was kind of crazy considering the fact all I did before I got into the insurance industry was operations. What do I know, right? but you know, it to me, the operations piece has been the more difficult part. And you know, part of that is because I worked for companies that had everything already built, right? Yeah. So for me, like if I were to go into a Brightway model, you know, like Billy Wagner, or, you know, even go into like a Farmers or an Allstate or a State Farm, the one advantage I think that those people have that the rest of us don't is everything's already built out for them. It's you're going to use this, you're going to use this, and this is how we do these things. For some people that works, you know, my issue, and for me, that would actually be a preferred method, honestly, but where they lose me is probably the same place they lost you. I'm way too entrepreneurial to be wearing red and khaki every day. That's why I left Target, right? So I'm not going to go do the same thing at State Farm. Nothing against State Farm, but I can't be beholden to somebody else's rules for how I'm going to build my business, you know, and I just can't do that.
And that's kind of what happened on both sides. It was, you know, they would have a flavor of the month, like, hey, this month we're selling hospital income. And I was like, I can't keep turning my agency and I'm still learning insurance. And now I'm turning it every month to their whim. Mm-hmm. So it was more their agenda than mine. And you're right, with the entrepreneurial side of, hey, I want to build a niche. You know, you can't really do that in the captive world. The captive world's very narrow, very focused, but the training is phenomenal. I think that's where the captives really do very, very well. And you're right, it's all built out. I mean, I didn't know the difference between a CRM, a management system, and a rater, because they were all the same, right? They're all fully integrated. You just plug it in here and it goes out the back end. And so, you know, it's hard to unlearn a lot of that, but the huge advantage we have as independents, obviously, is we can do what we want, but that's also can be a huge disadvantage because, as we all know, there's so many ways to do this and so many things out there, and everyone has a very strong opinion.
No, do they?
Yeah, no, shocking. And what I like is the people that say, and I think you said it a lot, David, when you talk about HubSpot. You know, HubSpot's great, but HubSpot, I couldn't use HubSpot. I'm not big enough, smart enough. You have a developer. You know, again, I've listened to a lot of your podcasts and other podcasts, and that's the advice people need to hear is, okay, here's what I do. Here's why I do it, but this might not fit you. So don't go out and buy HubSpot and Salesforce and spend God only knows how much money and be a small agency because you'll get buried.
Well, I mean, the principles are the same, right? I mean, you need to track contact information. You need to track your sales process so that you can analyze where things are falling off in your pipeline. All of the basics are the same regardless of what platform you use. You know, do we have some pretty cool tricks and bells and whistles? We absolutely do, but those cost money. And I, you know, you're right. I'm 100% transparent about that stuff, man. I don't want to see agents go out and buy something and eventually either spend way more money than they should or not use it and end up scrapping it all together. There are so many things out there, but it's funny as you were talking through that right before you said people have such strong opinions. I was just thinking to myself, I love watching all these people fight over why their stuff is the best and their answer's the best, right? And I mean, the internet makes us bulletproof behind monitors in so many ways. But the truth is, you know, you go out and we're in a lot of the same groups. We go out into these agency groups and you post a question and you'll get 15 responses or 20 different responses. And you don't even know who the people are that are answering the question. Mm-hmm. Like, what kind of business is it that you write? Are you commercial? Are you personal? Are you life? Are you health? Mm-hmm. Are you doing Medicare? How many employees do you have? What's the volume of your agency? I mean, there are so many variables that come in and, you know, everybody throws their 2 cents in. Like, their answer is the only one that would work. And that's just not true. I mean, it might work for you, just like HubSpot works for me. But I've been very clear about the fact that if I wasn't forced to have HubSpot, like I got my hand forced on it. I signed the contract. The deal we bought it for fell through like 2 weeks later. And here I am stuck with a piece of software for 3 years or two years or 3 years. I can either honor my word and pay for it on a monthly basis and do nothing with it, or I can double down, build it out and hope that it, you know, hope for the best that it's going to bring in the revenue to pay for it, yep. Which we obviously chose the latter. But, you know, we're probably still, I mean, as much money as we've spent on it, I bet you we're not even using 20%, 15, 20% tops mm-hmm. of what it's capable for. And so it's really a long-term play.
Yeah,
and you know, again, it goes back to what I said, processes, right? So from an operations perspective, even if you're going to go down that road, you better have your processes defined. I mean, how do you even know what to automate if you haven't defined what you're doing?
Yeah, exactly. And you bring up a great point. I think the other thing, and I've been very guilty of this, is we buy these big systems and we use 10% of them. And then we post in those Facebook groups, oh, this thing stinks. Well, right. No, it doesn't, Rob. You stink because you're not using it correctly. You haven't been trained correctly. And, you know, we just did a switch from EasyLinks to HawkSoft. And we're still in the midst of that switch. And we're learning stuff every day. And we have a trainer. I mean, we have someone who's training us every week. And she's used it for 25 years, owned an agency, has the background. And we still find stuff like, wow, it does this. Wow, it does that. But, right. You know, that's the thing people have to understand is I think you're right. You start with what do you want to do? What do you want to be when you grow up? And then what do you bring in? Price is a factor. But again, I feel like I'm just blowing smoke here, David. But I love what you say about it's not an expense. It blows me away. And, you know, that people say, oh, well, I'm spending this much. I'm like, stop. Like, people argue with me about ePay. Oh, no, it's $20 a month. Why are we having this conversation? If it does one check a month,
right.
One,
yeah,
it probably saved you how much effort chasing checks. You know, like I said, in New York, we do a lot of excess surplus. I don't know if we're unique and you have a lot of that in Florida where you are, but we do a lot of it. So it's all applications. It's all paper. It's all checks. And now we don't accept checks. And
or if it saves you from one NSF, you've made money.
Yeah, well, exactly. And so, and people are like, well, but you know, I don't really use it very much. And I'm just like, stop having this argument. It's, you know, and even something that's a couple $100, it's like, are you getting the value out of it? And don't equate it to, okay, yeah, yes, at some point you have a profit loss statement, right? You got to be really careful with it. You can't just buy everything and then end up, you know, hey, look, I've got all these cool tools and I'm losing money in my agency. But at some point you got to just say, this will save us X amount of time. This will keep my producers happy. You know, just that's worth the price of admission as opposed to saying, okay, I need you to get a check from that person. I need you to get all these things manually signed in wet signatures. I mean, that's just got awful.
It's the time for sure. I was going to ask about the excess and surplus. Is that just due to the market up there or it's, I mean, it seems like that's the case and it's not something that you actually had kind of, you know, went after or am I wrong?
It, it's the market and it's our Department of Insurance.
And it's also attorneys, right? Like a lot of this stuff from a contractor standpoint, just some of the liability laws and everything that happen, especially in New York City. But I mean, it's the entire state. The standard carriers just aren't going to accept the risk. I mean, it's a roll of the dice, man, as to how bad a claim is going to be when you have one.
Yeah, I mean, we have the scaffolding law, which has a lot of different names. But yeah, that one means everyone on the job site's liable if I drop a brick and hit David on his head and I'm a mason. How do you underwrite for that? You can't.
How do you even quantify that risk? It's impossible.
You can't. So there's one market. There's one or two carriers that do it. So it's all excess surplus. The other problem is getting rate increases, form changes, things like that. The Department of Insurance was slow before COVID. Now it's like a 2 to 3 year process. So you're how do you manage a business when you need a price increase today, but you won't see it for 3 years? So a lot of the products that they use, they'll come in excess surplus lines. And honestly, the state makes money. There's a surplus line tax of 3%. So they like that. So they're making revenue, but it creates a paperwork disaster. And so we have other systems we use to kind of make that more digitized. But
oh, I hate it, man. I hate excess and surplus lines.
Most people
do. It is
unfortunately
a necessary evil in Florida, and it's only going to get worse because we're dealing with the property market shifting and getting incredibly harder. But I don't
envy you guys. I'll take what I have up here, but at least you know you're dealing that just with property and homeowner. I mean, basic stuff, and you know your guys come in, go out, non-renew. You know, and you're just chasing carriers as they try to figure out what they want to do. And
the problem is, you know, we don't have a lot of national carriers. So it's not like a carrier can just shift appetite to another business segment and you can allocate critical mass over there and adapt with them. It's nope, we're out. Sorry.
Well, someone was posting in, I think it was IOA, that like one carrier pulled out and they had 35,000 policies. They're not renewing everybody. Just put out a press release. I mean, think
about
that.
It was like three or four weeks ago. It may have been a little bit longer than that. It was definitely in the last 4 to 6 weeks. It was a press release that came out in the newspaper that said 52,000 people were left without coverage when three carriers were approved to stop writing and leave the state.
Yeah.
And it's a vicious cycle, man. You know, they'll write and they'll write and they'll write and then they'll pull this crap and they'll leave and it'll go into Citizens, which is the state, you know, the state fund or state insurance company. And then it'll fester there for 5 or 10 years. And then these companies that are Citizens carve-outs will be backed by venture capital or hedge funds. They'll start buying blocks of business out of Citizens and setting up insurance companies with them, and the cycle starts all over again. All of these companies are the same. I mean, to me, every single carrier obviously coverage forms and things are modified, but if you look at the demographic of them, they're all monoline, Demotech A-rated home carriers. We don't even bundle. What's bundle? Why, you know?
Yeah,
well, we don't have bundle down here.
Yeah.
We can write your home. I mean, you want us to bundle your auto and umbrella? I mean, it's tough. And so then you run into the issues with like the progressives of the world who you should be able to bundle with, but they had a moratorium on appointments. So we had to wait 3 years just to even get approved to write auto. Then they want to have you hit your production requirements, which they should, but can't get the bundle until you write enough monoline auto to do that. And it's all based on personal lines policy count, not commercial, as far as the way I understand it. And we're getting undercut by platinum agents who have better better rates, right? So we'll quote stuff with Progressive, and unless they just really like Kyle, he ain't going to close it.
Which they don't.
Yeah.
So that's interesting that they want you to do the auto first and, you know, amass a certain amount of premium. I would think that why wouldn't they want you to just be able to do home, auto, umbrella, all that stuff together? I mean, that would put more business with them.
Right. Well, they want you to prove that you can write the auto first. So I guess if you can deal with all of the, you know, writing insurance with two arms tied behind your back, You know, it's just that number, you've proven yourself worthy.
Well, it's the same thing they did in New York when they wanted to see if I could write enough auto. Once I did, they made me a platinum agent and allowed me to write their home. And now they allow me to write their umbrella. Right. And now we can bundle everything. But I had to show them that I could hit a certain number on the auto side, because that's their bread and butter. You know,
well, that's again, the thing that sucks, man, because for me, the way that we want to approach it, I want to lead with the umbrella, right? I want to talk to people about their liability exposures and take a little bit of the risk management bent to the personal side of things. And the reason I want to do that is because I know that if I lead with the umbrella and I have them convinced that that makes sense, I'm automatically going to get the underlying limits that I need on the auto and control that. And I'm going to get the home as well, at least get the look at
it. Good way to
do it. So it's a much better approach. The problem is, you know, we're having to cobble stuff together and write monoline umbrellas with USLI, or if auto owners is competitive on their pricing, which it's hit or miss, you know, we can write auto and umbrella with auto owners. We can write auto and umbrella with Safeco, but you don't have the home. You know, we can write auto and umbrella with Nationwide. Like everybody we have, we can write auto and umbrella, except Progressive, who happens to be the most competitive most of the time on the auto. We can't get the umbrella product. So it kind of puts a wrinkle in our strategy.
Yeah. And it's hard to cobble that all together. Like you said, you know, getting a monoline umbrella from USLI, there's a lot of service work with the deck pages every single year. There's a lot, you know, I mean, it's a lot of
places stuff can fall through the cracks too.
Exactly.
What happens
if I forgot about my boat?
Yeah. Or what happens if you don't control the home? Now you got to get the deck page from the agent who does, so you can make sure that you got that policy declared on the umbrella as the underlying. I mean, look, I'm not a personal lines fan anyhow, so this doesn't make me love it anymore. You know, I can tell you.
That's true.
Well, listen, so, you know, you've gotten into the independent channel from the captive world. What's been the biggest challenge you've had so far?
I think the biggest challenge was an epiphany I had about 2 years ago when I started to think about going independent. And, you know, when you don't have the backing of the captive, you don't have all the systems, all of a sudden you're the decision maker. Like you can actually make the decision. So we would joke in my office, they'd come in and say, hey, what about this? And I'd turn around and there's no one behind me. So, you know, it's being that agency owner, because you truly are an owner at this point. You truly are an entrepreneur. You're not a producer for a captive. That's how I kind of felt as a captive agent. I really wasn't an agent. I was more of a producer. And, you know, so the struggle is the whole, how do you run the business? You know, it's that whole, I've read E-Myth, I've read, you know, a lot of Traction. I'm trying to read all these books just to learn, how do you run an agency from a P&L perspective, from a, you know, all of that, because first you need to get the system so you have the data, right? That's your first struggle. And then even when you get the data, now what's a good number? You know, I've heard on many podcasts, yours included, that, you know, that conversation about revenue. And what's a good revenue number? Everyone's different, right? You don't know. So it's, you have to learn, what do you want to be? And then you have to try to figure out, what are the metrics? What are the KPIs that you need to focus on as the owner? And then more importantly, I think, is to push that down to producers and your team so they understand the KPIs. So, hey, we're going to talk about this every week. We're going to talk about this every month. And here's the number, and here's what it means. And here's where I came up with it. And that's really been the struggle, as you know, going independent, because you don't have that crutch. And honestly, the captive people, that, you know, just the way they would monitor you and the way they would, you know, grade you. We did very well for years, for 5 years. We made all the trips and all everything, but it was based on policy count. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not a good metric. I mean, that's one metric, right? You want to know how many policies you have, but yeah, exactly. Thank you, Kyle. I mean, I could have 4,000 renters policies and you guys could have, you know, 20 commercial policies and you have more premium than I do.
Yep.
Right. So it's what's your mix of business. And so it's switching the mindset and really deciding, what do you want to do? How do you want to do it? And then really just running the business. That's been my struggle, honestly. And I think it's a continuing struggle. I think it's one of those things you always keep learning, but that's where I'm in a lot of these Facebook groups and trying to find mentors. And, you know, like Chris's mastermind in Boston was eye-opening to me. You know, that was the cream of the crop. That was, these guys know what they're doing, know how to do it, and are willing to spend time with you and talk and spend an hour saying, okay, you know, no, that's not a good idea, Rob. Let's, you know, here's why. Let's try this. And it really makes a big difference. But that's been my biggest struggle.
What about most rewarding thing?
Just the most rewarding thing is knowing it's mine. You know, it's my book mm-hmm. of business. It's my asset. It's my annuity stream. And it can be whatever it wants. So as we have the wins during the month and we, you know, we're writing policies and things like that, it's building that long-term wealth. You know, this is a get-rich-slow business, depending on how quick you grow, obviously. Some people can grow really, really quick. But, you know, it's very rewarding to know this is mine. You know, this is me and my team. We own this thing. And, you know, like I said, every day is an adventure. You know, I love what you never know what's going to happen every day. We're, you know, we're a pretty That's small for sure. agency. So, so, you know, and right now I'm still the head cook and chief bottle washer. And that's fun to a certain point, but you know, the goal is to pull out of that as quickly as possible and have my team run it. And I've got a great team. I think it's just the wins you get, because now I'm winning for me. I'm not winning for someone else.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to keep some district manager happy or mm-hmm. make some trip. Now the trips are nice, but if you make those trips, but you're not profitable,
yeah,
what's the point, right?
I mean, if you're generating enough revenue, you can take those trips yourself and do whatever you want.
Well, it became evident, like with State Farm, they would get, I wasn't there long enough to make a trip, but they would send them an income. It was a tax event.
Oh, yeah.
They would get an income event of $15,000. And I'm like, okay, the trip was nice, but 15?
Yeah.
I could... You know, my whole family could go. You know, so that number's really high. And same thing with farmers. They canceled their trip during COVID and they gave every agent like $6,000. And of course the agents went crazy and like, I don't want the trip. You know, 4 days in Scottsdale, Arizona is not $6,000.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm sorry. You know, no matter where you stay. So but you know, that's, you know, it gets back to that, you know, focus on it's a mind shift, and that's fun. I'm enjoying it, but I'm still got a lot to learn.
I have got a buddy of mine that is a producer and a partner in an agency. I've actually got several buddies that are going through this exact same thing right now, where they're the next generation, right? They're producers in agencies, but they have a bit of an equity stake that ranges all over the board. But the agency principals are ready to go. Like they're on the glide path. They know they're going to be gone in the next, you know, no more than probably 2 or 3 years. And I was having a conversation with my one buddy the other day, and he said, I can't even imagine what it's going to be like. I've never been in the industry before where I actually get the lion's share of the revenue as opposed to, you know, just the producer's cut. And I think that's one of the biggest things. I don't understand, and I'm not asking you to get into this at all, but the way that I understand the captive model, and I think that I'm probably pretty close because you alluded to it, is they're keeping a chunk of the change, man. So you are essentially, you're essentially a producer. You're not making independent agency principal bank, you know, when you're working with these people. And so to move to the independent channel where now all of a sudden it's not just a commission, but you get to keep the profit as well, or as much of it as you're going to keep without reinvesting it. You just got to, you have to produce less to make the same amount of money. So the ramp up should be much quicker for you, I would think.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. I mean, farmers is 10 and 10. Mm. So let's do the simple math. If you're bundling, you're probably getting 15, 20. So my homes are double the commission right off the bat. The auto is 50% increase. So you do the backwards math. You don't have to write as much. Mm-hmm. And you know, the nice part too is just the fact that you can help everybody, right? You're not trying to put a square peg into a round hole. You know, you walk into a captive, you got a price. And how do you get that price lower? Well, we all know how you do that. You reduce coverages, you raise with having multiple carriers and having some be hot at points and some are cold at points, Yeah, we don't want to remarket our book all the time, but we have that ability to keep clients happy and to funnel business to carriers that you either like, that have great technology. I mean, I've told carriers that I'm not writing your business. You're still on Internet Explorer. Are you kidding me? I mean, I got to go in and clear the cache and look north and go on one foot and pray to somebody to get this thing to even work. And then we changed an auto and it took us 2 hours. I mean, come on. I mean, I should be able to write. I don't write medium-sized businesses like you do, but you know that doesn't take 2 hours. And I'm changing one vehicle on a personal auto policy. I mean, you know, there's a lot of talk about that in the industry, which I think is great. And I've told the marketing reps, I'm not writing you. You know, hey, you're down this month. I'm like, your system is god awful. You know, your service center is not responding. I don't need to spend time doing this stuff. You know, give me a system. I can write, I can quote quickly, good forms. And if a client has a question, everything's right there. Don't push all the captive model to your question, David, pushes all the service work down to the agents. You can't do that in the independent world because we have choices.
Mm-hmm.
So, because it makes you less profitable. I mean, let's be honest, you got to hire 6 service people to service a book of business. It doesn't work at some point, you know, make it efficient.
Right.
So what was the transition like? You got out of the military and decided to go into the insurance industry. I mean, talk a little bit about that, because I want that to be segue into what we're going to go into next with your Suits for Soldiers program.
Perfect segue. Thank you, David. Transition out of the military. When I got out, it was have a nice day. There was no transition assistance programs. There was no prepping you for the real world. There's none of that. Fortunately for me, I had enough connections in the Wall Street world that I met people that told me, okay, you need to buy a suit. Got to wear a white shirt and a red tie. No stripes, no dots, no nothing. This was back in the 90s. So that was the uniform.
I don't know that that's changed any, honestly. I mean, even as a producer, if I'm going to meet with an attorney or an accountant or anybody financial, I am typically going to be solid navy blue suit with a white shirt and a solid color tie, or maybe like a striped rep tie. That's it. Yep. Like as conservative as you can possibly get. Now, I've done that before, and I've had attorneys show up wearing like a purple suit with it. So now you know what the rules are.
With yellow story. Polka dots.
Yeah, it's a little different story, but I mean, that's good advice, man. And I mean, that's, you're always safe, you know.
Right.
Always overdress. Don't be always be the best dressed guy in the room. But the transition, the toughest part of the transition, and this will lead right into suits, is in the military, you've got what my kids just call play clothes, right? Probably we're all in that now. We're all at home. You're in a pair of shorts and a t-shirt. You're comfortable. In the military, you don't have khakis. Like, I wore khakis. That was my uniform, but I didn't have a pair of khakis. I didn't have button downs. I had some golf shirts because I played golf. So you have your play clothes and you have your military uniform, and you're told every day what to wear. The plan of the day, every day in the military says you wear this thing today. Being in aviation, I wore a flight suit. So I wore basic pajamas every day, which was great. But you don't need those things. If you go to a formal event, you'd wear your military, you know, choker whites or service dress blues in the Navy. You don't own suits. You don't even own business casual, because when would you wear it, right? There's no reason to wear it. And I mean, certainly in the Navy and the other services, you're deployed a lot of the time. I mean, I was home 87 days one year on U.S. soil. That's just the way it is. So you've got your workout clothes, your play clothes, you've got your military uniform, and that's all you need. And so that transition to the civilian world, to first of all figure out what you're supposed to wear, but then to go out and get it, or you might not be able to afford it, you know, it depends on how you were in the military. And it's just, you know, and then trying to translate what you did to the civilian world is hard. And if you get lucky and get a veteran who's asking you an interview question, at least they get it. But that's where the suits come in, because they become more of a symbol of a lot of other services we try to provide to the veterans. So they know how to present themselves, because some of them, especially someone who's been in for 20 years, they have no idea. But even 4 years, I did 8 years. You know, you really, most of these kids come out of high school, right out of high school and right into the military.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
they might have had jobs in high school, but they've never really had one of those, you know, call it a career job.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a tough transition, because you got to be able to present yourself correctly. And, you know, job fairs. I mean, really, it's about translating that military experience. You know, like I always joke, you know, I was in the Navy, but, I, you know, guy in the Army, what'd you do? I blew things up. Great. Well, we don't really want you here. We don't want you, you know, so how do you do that? But the suit at least gives them the comfort that they're dressed correctly. There's a lot of job fairs to kick off this. You know, how do you set up your LinkedIn profile? Back in the day, it was resumes. How do you write a resume? You know, mm-hmm. So
it's amazing how many people I tell that to, man. I mean, producers especially just don't get the fact you don't need a resume. Anybody that wants to check you out is going to go look at your agency's website, and then they're going to look at LinkedIn, and not necessarily in that order. If they go to your LinkedIn profile and it's hot garbage, then you're probably not going to get a phone call back, you know, mm-hmm. And that's not just for interviewing for jobs. It's for meeting with prospects. You know, I know who looks at my LinkedIn profile. I can see it all the time. And, you know, I'm not overly concerned. I think mine's in pretty good shape. But I go to people's, like, I'll have people reach out and say, hey, I'd like to be a producer in your agency. I'll go look at their LinkedIn profile. I'm like, you can't even get your freaking LinkedIn profile built out. How are you going to understand what we do? You know?
Well, or they don't have a picture. But a lot of times in the military, think about it. If you're in, like, for me, I was in for 8 years. I wouldn't even have known what LinkedIn was. Now, LinkedIn didn't exist when I was in the military, but I'd say it came out now.
Mm-hmm.
I was in for 8 years. The social media has changed in the last 8 years, in case anyone's lived under a rock. And,
you know what? And here's the thing, man. Most people don't realize this, but LinkedIn is actually the oldest of the social networks. So I was an early adopter of LinkedIn back in 04 or 05, and it was already several years old. So to your point, even if they did exist, nobody was using it. Like, I remember going into the agency I was at and said, I really need to make sure I spend time here. I want to start building relationships online. I can see business going here in the future. And the people laughed at me. And mm-hmm. those very same people are posting multiple times a day now, sharing all kinds of crap across LinkedIn. And I'm like, ah, yeah.
Gotcha.
I remember. Let me run into you on the streets and remind you of what an idiot I was for recommending that we build out a practice on this platform.
Well,
but it's easy, man.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's interesting, though. I mean, because the first piece of all that is the appearance, going back to the suits, right? Is I mean, you've got to at least look the part, right? It's like, what did Deion Sanders say? You know, if you look good,
I don't know,
play
because
good,
that guy,
you play good.
Oh, yeah.
You look good, you feel good, you feel good, you play good, you play good, you get paid good. So, yeah.
I thought he said, give me that extra wide navy white pinstripe. That's probably what he said.
Probably.
Knowing Deion, yes.
That's something you don't think of. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, because think about it, Kyle. I mean, think about first impressions. If I'm coming in to interview with you and I'm not really sure what to wear, I'm going to wear what I have,
mm-hmm.
but maybe I show up in a golf shirt and a pair of khakis.
Yep.
Because I don't know any different. And your first impression is this kid can't even dress.
Mm-hmm. No,
it's a steep hill.
Yeah. I mean, that was a situation I ran into in college. I remember I was on campus and I was like in between classes and there was some dude, you know, recruiting for Cutco to sell the knives. And he was like, come by for an interview at this time, whatever. I was like, okay. So I went straight there after class, like, and I had on a golf shirt and I had on khakis, like you said. And the guy, you know, I show up and the guy's like, you know, he comes out in a suit and everything. And so obviously I immediately feel underdressed or whatever, but he's like, yeah, usually I don't, you know, even interview people who aren't dressed in suits, but, you know, I don't remember what his explanation was after that, but he ended up interviewing me and I think for a position like that, it doesn't really matter. They're going to basically, you know, grab anybody they can to get them to try to sell their knives and all
are
that.
Are you really going to wear a suit to go sell Cutco?
No.
I mean, come on, man.
No, you're not.
But that might have been the uniform that they expected. And, and some of it too. And
look,
again,
I'm of that mindset. I'm old school enough. I mean, I would have people come in to interview for a job bagging groceries, and typically, you know, my first store was not in the best part of town, and I wanted to make sure that I ran the cleanest operation there, and I'd have some kid come in with his pants sagging, his t-shirt untucked, showing up for an interview that could barely even put a sentence together. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm sorry. I thought you came here to interview for a job. Are you looking for a donation? I mean, what's the problem? You know, go home and get changed. If you're serious, go home and dress like you're coming to talk to me about whether or not I'm willing to pay you to represent me in front of all these people in the store right now, because right now you couldn't represent me. Mm-hmm. And if they would go home and they would come back changed, I wouldn't even ask them any questions. They were hired on the spot because it told me they were coachable and that they had the ability. If they didn't,
I mean, when we first met, when I was meeting you about coming on at FRP, I showed up in a suit and you're like, dude, you're way too overdressed. I'm just like,
yeah,
well,
but you need to
I'm
let
not
me be
show-
the one to say that.
I know, exactly. Yeah. I'm not going to show up in a freaking wife beater. Like, I mean, come on.
That would be awesome. You did.
with a pair of shorts halfway around your ankles. Yeah, that's impressive.
Yeah, right. I mean, but I think that there's something to be said for that. You know, I also think that there's something to be said, though, for the fact that we, even today, I think it's gotten better, and I would be interested in your opinion on this, but I feel like we could do a better job of equipping the people that are leaving the military after serving our country to integrate into the workforce. And there are certainly way more resources, at least more than I'm aware of, than there have been a decade ago, 2 decades ago, whatever else. But I still think we could do a better job. I mean, there are a lot of things from financial training to you know, how to get a job, like you said, just, you know, basic things like LinkedIn that we take for granted that everybody should know. It's just a normal tool in our toolbox. Mm-hmm. These guys, they've only been able to do things one way for so long, and they're not always exposed to that. But I mean, I think that we all need to be in a position to where we're setting our military people up for success when the day comes that they leave. Because, you know, let's face it, man, you go in and you put 20 hard years in the military and retire, or some people even earlier than that, you're not going to want to just sit at home and do nothing. All of these people have something to contribute and want to contribute. And I think we need to do a better job of setting them up. So that kind of leads into what I wanted to talk to you about today. And that's the program that you're a part of. I don't know if it's something that you started. We didn't get into that level of detail, but the Suits for Soldiers program. Why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that that's something that literally anybody and everybody in that listens to this podcast can contribute to and help with. And it, guess what? Doesn't really cost you anything. It's going to actually help you, like it will in my world. It's going to help me declutter a closet that my daughter probably would like to use in her room.
There you go. Well, I'll just give you the quick genesis. So 5 years ago, prior to Veterans Day, Farmers sent out a package to all of us saying we're going to collect suits in the Northeast, like the five or six states in the Northeast. So I was like, great. This is, you know, typical corporate America. Sent it out November 10th. Veterans Day, November 11th. So I call the guy running it. I'm like, oh, this is great. Now tell me about the program. Tell me what you want us to do. Tell me where they're going to go. They hadn't thought about the distribution side of it. So it's just collect them and we'll figure it out. I'm like, well, that's not going to work. So my office, we collected 1,600 suits in 5 weeks.
Damn.
Off of one ad in a local paper. I mean, talk about a marketing. Talk about a marketing. A woman came in to interview me like the first week, and we had a little blurb in the Chronicle, and we were collecting 30 suits a day.
That's crazy.
So that's how we started. And the problem is we ended up with all these suits and no place to put them. So we connected with McGuire Air Force Base down in New Jersey. They have a transition assistance program, and every week we'd box them up and mail them to them. And I realized that wasn't a long-term game. So that's when I met Save a Suit out of Bethel, Connecticut, run by an Air Force veteran named Scott Sokolowski. And he's like, I'll take your suits. I saw him on LinkedIn and said, hey, you know, I called him like, hey, what are you doing? And he's like, oh, this is what I do. I do job fairs. I do this. I'm like, oh, I'm collecting suits. Can I give them to you? He said 100%. So that was 5 years ago. I lost track. I mean, we collect interview clothes and shoes and socks. And but the power of it is now in my area, people know me as the suit guy. Or know me as I'll collect. I got a phone call from a woman closing down a Naturalizer store, which is a women's shoe store. And she's like, I got 85 pairs of brand new shoes I need to donate. Will you take them? I said, of course I will.
Nice.
Joseph A. Banks was donating to Rotary, and they were donating button downs. And they were going over to Vietnam with clothes. Well, the guy said, you know, Vietnamese men tend to be smaller than American men. So he had larges and extra larges and mediums that weren't going to fit. And he's like, will you take them? I'm like, sure. So this dude shows up with 12 boxes of shirts in their bags, brand new. So
man, you got to be careful up there in New York, man. You start selling fine men's or having fine men's clothing on the back of a truck, they're going to wonder
well,
where you got it from.
I'm glad you bring it up, David, because when the guy called me from Rotary, he's like, hey, listen, I got 12 boxes of shirts. I said, did they fall off the back of a truck? He said, no. And he told me the story. And I figured it was from Rotary, so I figured it was legit. But that's kind of how we started. And then once I got connected with Scott, you know, again, he does job fairs. He does, you know, what they do is they bring veterans together and they do the LinkedIn training. They'll do resume writing if they need to. They also bring in mental health if needed, which is a big problem in the military right now. I won't go down that rabbit hole, but we all know the issue there. And so now you're bringing veterans out of the military. And some of these guys have been out for years. Some have just getting out. And now you're bringing, like you said, David, those resources to make them presentable, to make them understand what they need to do in the civilian world. And the biggest struggle with veterans is there's a lot of resources, but the Department of Defense and the VA, which takes care of the veterans when they get out, they can't communicate. It's a privacy issue. So first you got to find the veterans and then you got to get the resources to them. So there's a lot of task force I'm on to get people together and get that done. But the suit becomes a symbol. You know, the suit becomes, hey, well, at least we'll dress them correctly. And it is men's and women's. I want to make that clear.
Yes, thank you. Because if you didn't, Lord knows I would get railroaded on it. Like I'm the biggest chauvinist known to man when that couldn't be further from the truth.
And I'm the same way because people say, oh, you collect women's? I'm like, yes, of course I do. There's women defending this country too. But they, you know, they bring those resources. And the other problem, honestly, is veterans, and I'm one of them. You know, how you doing? I'm fine. Need any help? Nope, I'm good.
Right.
They don't ask for help. They don't ask for help. So it's hard to say, hey, we're going to help you. Hey, we can do this. So that's where this comes in of, you know, we're not going to charge you. We're just going to have a suit for you. What Scott's also done a great job of is you reach out to these big companies to talk about hiring veterans and say, okay, put your money where your mouth is. Rent a convention center. We'll show up with 400 or 500 veterans dressed, ready to go. They're not going to say no to that. So, you know, it's about exposing them to the civilian world, making them understand, you know, how the process works. And to give them a better shot at getting those jobs. Because, I mean, obviously I'm very prejudiced towards veterans, but veterans are coachable, trainable. They all went through boot camp. Mm-hmm. They might not have the exact skill set the civilian world is looking for, but I'll hire a veteran any day because I know I can train him or her. And honestly, in today's world, they also know how to show up on time. That's a hard thing for a lot of people. Let's be honest.
Four things, man. Four things right here. These are the four things that I tell everybody. Show up on time. Return emails and phone calls promptly. Do what you say you're going to do. And if you don't know the answer, admit you don't know the answer, but you know the guy who knows the answer, get it and get back to them in a timely fashion. If you can do those four things in the insurance industry, I don't care if you're a one-man shop selling personal lines or you're out producing middle market accounts, you're ahead of your competition because they can't even get those four things right.
100%. It's all about the simple, do the basic blocking and tackling. And my view of it is, the veterans, and yes, with having a lot of veterans, is every veteran, you know, I mean, we're going to have some people that aren't great people, and that's just the nature of the beast. But in general,
that's
someone
anywhere,
does,
though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Someone decided to give Uncle Sam a blank check, joined the military for whatever reason, got out. I mean, my personal view is it's our obligation to help them. It's personally my obligation to help them. And I always preach this to people. If we all do a little bit, and that's what I love about the suits. Like you said, David, it's very easy. I mean, I literally, when I do a presentation for mortgage lenders or realtors or whatever I'm doing, I always get 5 minutes at the end. I'm like, and it's a direct ask. Hey, I'm looking for suits. I'm looking for clothes. I'm looking for whatever. Here's my office, my physical office. Just bring them by, and I'll collect 50 to 100 suits doing that. And the other thing I've been very cognizant of, because our industry has a bad rep in general, is I don't take names and addresses of people that have donated, because I don't want them to think I'm going to leverage off of this and start marketing to them. So
yeah.
Because that would be god awful. And so I've been accused of it. I've had people accuse me of it, and I bring them in and I explain what I do, and that's fine. I mean, if you don't have haters in the world, it means you're not pushing the limit, right? You're not pushing the edge of the envelope. But you know, it having the physical office, having the ability to collect these suits, a lot of people now, as my network has expanded, now they can mail them directly to save a suit. Also, just a quick plug. It does cost money to ship these things out, so there is a donate button on their website. I'm not a 501c3, but he is. So that's where the tax deductions come in, if that's important to people.
Here's a fun fact. How about if you're not going to send a suit, you donate some coin for the shipping people? I mean, yep. Not everybody has a suit that they can donate. That's okay. You probably got some pocket change. Don't buy the extra pack of cigarettes tomorrow. You know, don't do that for the next month, and you've got enough to ship about 20 suits.
Yeah, well, it costs about $40 to ship is what we do. And we do it online. There, with COVID, we learned how to virtual tailor people, which is pretty cool, I think. Huh. And, you know, Scott's got, I mean, probably 5,000 to 7,000 suits sitting in his warehouse. And we keep plugging more stuff in. He's got about 8 collection facilities. And but, you know, you can really, the suit becomes the start of a process. How do you integrate these young men and women back into the military, back out of the military, into the civilian world? And this is one way to do it. And then you bring in all these other resources. I mean, we had a women veteran job fair all ready to go in October, and then COVID hit. But we were going to bring in, you know, nail salons, hair people, all these other people. Because if I walk into a business and say, hey, listen, we're doing a job fair for veterans, would you donate some of your time? Everybody has said yes to me. Nobody says no to me. And being insurance, we're all fairly good salespeople, but this is an easy, easy sell. And most people want to help. And if we all do a little bit, it's kind of my mantra here, we all do a little bit, the impact we can have is enormous. And
yeah,
helping these kids.
So how about you put down the bag of crunchy Cheetos right now and figure out, are you going to get in shape and fit into your thin suits? Or are you going to continue to wear your fat boy suits? And that's me talking to myself, right?
Yep.
That's where I'm at, because I told Rob I've probably got 20 suits I could send. And then all of a sudden I decided to get off my rear end and start working out again. And I've lost a bunch of weight. So I'm in that weird tweener stage where I'm not sure which way I'm going to go, but I'm pretty sure it's not going to be back up. So the suits I was going to donate, it actually is probably a little easier because they all have my name sewn inside of them because they were custom tailored. And the ones that I bought off the rack are probably more practical for somebody coming out of the military. But, you know, people, you just have to make the decision you want to help. You know, everybody can sit out there and talk about it and say, oh, I wish there was something I could do. Well, guess what? There is. And now we just told you what it was. So do it.
Yep. Yeah. And it's easy. Like I said, donate. You can donate cash. You can donate whatever. I mean, if you're local, obviously we can. I can. You know, you can drop it by my office, or if you're far enough away, you just mail it. I mean, it's not that hard. But I appreciate that, Dave. It's 100%. It's very easy to do. Clean out your closets. I've had many spouses have walked in with their spouse's clothes and have loved it. Like, I finally got rid of these suits that my husband or my wife will never wear again. You know, so, you know, that cleaning out the closet thing is awesome.
So one more time, tell them how to get to you, where to send this stuff. I want you to make it abundantly clear. Give them the web address for the donation. And I want to make sure that we do everything we can. And then also we're going to capture that in the show notes. So if you aren't going to write it down when Rob tells you, We'll give you a link you can click on.
There you go. We'll make it simple for you. The organization is called SaveASuit. That's all one word, .org. My office is 845-610-5700. And my team is prepared to answer questions about this. So if you're local to the Northeast and want to drop them off, that's one way to do it. My website is patrioticinsurancegroup.com. And there is a tab for Suits for Soldiers, which has all the information right there. So I'll provide you with all those links, David, so you can put it in the show notes and people can just click and go.
Awesome. I appreciate it, and I look forward to it. Listen, I want to be respectful of time. We're on the hour. Thank you so much for coming on, Rob. I appreciate it. I hope that we're able to generate some activity for you. What I hope is that people don't hear that you have 500 suits and realize you need 5,000 instead, and that they continue to push the envelope forward. It's a good problem to have to need money to ship because people have been so abundantly generous in their giving. So that's why I'm going to call on everybody else. If you don't have the suit, help these guys out. Give them some money to ship suits to soldiers. You'll sleep much better at night, whether you realize it or not. I appreciate your service, man. Thank you. Yep. I mean, that was really an interesting era in our time. I'm a little bit younger than you. I was coming out of high school and was contemplating whether or not I was going to end up in Desert Storm at the time. So, I appreciate the fact that you went over there and that you have fought for the freedoms that we all take for granted so much. So thank you for that. People, help the soldiers out. End of story. We're going to wrap it up. Talk to you soon, buddy. Thank you again.
Thanks, David. Appreciate it. Kyle, thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Power Producers Podcast. You can follow Killing Commercial Insurance on Facebook and YouTube. And if you want to take your game to the next level, check out our book, The Extra 2 Minutes, and our website, killingcommercial.com.